And ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Blooming Basics for Z, VM, and Linux on System Z Part 1 teleconference. This call is being recorded. I'd like to turn the call back over to Julie Liesenfeld. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, John. And for those of you who've stuck with us for 3 hours, thank you for sticking with us. If you're just joining us, our final topic today is ZVM Control Program, CP, which is Useful Things to Know. Again, the handout is posted on three spots, on SSI, on Partner World, and on the ZVM T3 website. If you're on SSI, this is the third attachment down. This is 06-2210 P1C, CP Useful Things to Know. Our presenter, final presenter John, is going to pause several times throughout for Q&A, and before his final Q&A, we'll have a survey question for a quick polling. So, John, let me turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Julie, and welcome, everyone. My name is John Franciscovich. I work in the Endicott Programming Lab developing ZVM. I work primarily on the control program. Presentation today is going to cover things that if you're new to VM or been away from VM and coming back to VM after a while as a system programmer or somebody who's going to set up and install ZVM, things about the control program, information that might be helpful to you as far as where certain things are, what kind of information you need to know to get set up, and then once the system is running, how to access certain things. So if we go right to chart four, the topics, list of topics, we'll go over an overview of the facilities and the functions provided by the control program, or CP. We'll go through starting what you need to start to start your ZVM system, to IPL the control program, where and how we save and restore information, defining and creating virtual machines, which is where all the work gets done. A little bit about virtual machine connectivity and virtual networking. We're not going to go too deep into that because that's a whole different set of presentations. But just to touch on that, because it is part of the support that's provided with the control program, how you would interact with the control program, commands, programming interfaces, et cetera. And the last section we'll talk about is diagnostic information. Some of the information that's generated automatically, some things that are useful to collect while your system is running so that if there is a problem or a question about something that's going on, we can look back and see what was actually happening on your system. So let's go right to chart six. Some of these early charts may look familiar, may look similar to charts you've seen in some of the earlier presentations, but I promise you we're going to take them in a totally different direction. So stick with us if you've seen some of these before, or it sounds like I'm saying the same thing. So the control program controls the resources. It identifies the environment it's running in. VM runs in an LPAR or in a virtual machine as a guest of itself. Manages the real memory that's available to it and the devices among all of the virtual machines that are active and trying to get work done. Records data about system usage, virtual machine usage of resources, events that are happening on the system. Some of that is used for diagnostics. Some of it can be used for accounting and billing information, things like that. And a lot of error recovery. There's a lot of error recovery built into the control program. We can't always prevent an error from happening or prevent the system from restarting, but most of the time we can, and there's a lot of recovery facilities built in to preserve and restore data in the event of an error. We move on to chart seven. The picture here illustrates several guest virtual machines running, several virtual machines running guest operating systems under ZVM, or in a single instance of ZVM, I guess we should say. And the VM control program manages those virtual machines. That virtual machines are where all the work gets done on a VM system. So manages those virtual machines. The virtual machines will run either under Z architecture or ESA 390 architecture. The virtual machines run an all run operating systems inside themselves. Some of them are guest, other System Z operating systems that run as guests. And then there's an interactive operating system that's part of ZVM. So the guest operating systems, pretty much anything that runs on System Z can run on a virtual machine under a single instance of ZVM. You see one example of each here. You see a ZOS and a Linux and a VSE and a TPF and VM running as a guest of itself. Just because of the illustration, we show one, but there's no restrictions as far as what type of guests, how many virtual machines running each type of guests you can have. So you can have any number of any of these types of guests running in virtual machines under a single image of ZVM. There naturally are limits based on the capacity of your system, the amount of memory, the amount of storage, things like that, and the workload that you're running in those guests. But there's no architected number to the maximum, to the combination of how many of each type of guest. Now, I mentioned CMS being the interactive operating system. CMS comes with ZVM. It's part of the ZVM operating system, and it runs. It's the interactive virtual machine. It runs. It's the interactive interface to ZVM. No matter what you're using ZVM for, you'll be using several CMS virtual machines. Your operator will run under CMS. Your system programmer user IDs, such as Mate and Operatins and any others you set up, service virtual machines running directory managers, they all run under CMS. When you do, when you install ZVM or you apply service or change a configuration, that's all done in a CMS virtual machine. So the control program shares the resources that are available, the real resources that are available in the environment it's running in among all the virtual machines, and keeps them running efficiently, gives them each their turn, each their access to the various devices they need, and processors and memory, and keeps them all running so they all get their turns to get their work done. The other thing it the control program does is provides connectivity. Allows virtual machines to exchange data either by exchanging files with each other. You can set up virtual networks among the virtual machines, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. You can share data. They can have shared access to things like data on disk, data in memory, things like that. We move on to the next chart. This just illustrates you can have multiple layers of virtualization. I mentioned you can run ZVM in a virtual machine as a guest of ZVM, and that guest copy of ZVM will have its own virtual machines running as guests as well. We do this a lot here in the lab for testing. It's a great test environment. If you're installing a new release of ZVM, this is one of the methods you might use to do that. And test your virtual machines, your workload running in a guest environment. But there are multiple layers. We've heard of people creating 8 or 9 layers of ZVM. That's not really, there's no real practical use for that, and it's from a performance perspective, it's probably not practical to do anything useful, but it just proves the concept that you can layer your ZVMs and its guests several layers deep. So we can host ourselves as a guest and run more guests in that guest copy of ZVM. As far as devices, we have real devices and virtual devices. Real devices are the physical devices, your disk volumes, your tapes, maybe a printer, whatever physical devices you have attached to your system. Those are sensed by the control program. When you IPL the ZVM control program, it goes out and it finds all the devices that it has physical connections to, and it issues a command called a sense code to those devices, finds out what kind of device it is, and configures those devices accordingly. You don't have to define the devices that you want to use just as a the way they are configured, the default configuration for that type of device. You don't have to provide any definition or configuration information for those type of devices. If you want to alter the characteristics of a given device or a given type of devices, you can specify that in the system configuration file for that set of devices. So you can customize the devices, various devices to your needs. A real device can be attached or dedicated to a single virtual machine for its exclusive use. Most real devices are shared among the virtual machines by the control program, but you can dedicate specific devices to a specific virtual machine for its exclusive use. Most devices are virtualized among several virtual machines, and the control program controls the access so they don't update each other's data or destroy each other's data or get in each other's way. Step on it, you know, use each other's portions of those devices. Also, real devices, primarily disk, are used by the control program itself for system functions, and I'll talk about that in the next few charts. Virtual devices are what are defined to your virtual machines. All devices defined to a virtual machine are considered virtual devices. They get a virtual address, but they appear to that virtual machine as a real physical device. So you may assign part of a disk volume to a virtual machine, and to that virtual machine or the operating system running in that virtual machine, it appears as though that's a full disk volume to that virtual machine. The initial configuration for a virtual machine is in the user directory where all virtual machines are defined. So the initial set of devices for that virtual machine are defined in that virtual machine's directory entry. However, once the virtual machine is logged on and active, you can create new devices for that virtual machine simply by issuing a command, either a define command, or you can assign a device to that virtual machine with an assign or an attach command. So you define them in the directory. That's the base, the starting configuration for the virtual machine, and then you can add devices once the virtual machine is up and running. So virtual devices, we call them virtualized when an image of a real device is presented to the virtual machine. So we take a real device, we virtualize it, and the virtual machine sees it as a real device. Simulated, there doesn't have to be a real physical device associated with a virtual device. In that case, we call it a simulated device, where the virtual machine thinks it has a real device. He can read and write data from a device, say it's a virtual disk, but there's no physical device associated with that virtual device. So I mentioned the next chart now, CP disk space, chart number 10. I mentioned that the control program uses devices for system functions, and this is the primary example of that. The control program, you have a set of volumes that you defined in statements in your configuration file, your system configuration file, called CP-owned statements. So we call these volumes the CP-owned volumes, or the CP-owned list, and the control program owns this space for system functions. There are several types of space that you will allocate for use by the control program. The first one on the list there is PERM, or permanent space, and that contains things like the checkpoint and warm start areas where we save data. So when the system is shut down and restarted, we can restore the data that was on the system before it was shut down when it's restarted. So the checkpoint and warm start areas. So that's saved in what we call PERM space. User mini disks that contain user data and files. Of course, they could be on CP-owned. They will definitely always be on space allocated as permanent, may or may not be defined as a CP-owned volume. There's a user volume list as well. But we can have mini disks on those too, but it's in PERM space. Could contain a copy of the file containing the copy of the control program that you're running. But usually that's in the PERM space, which is the next type. PARM space is a special type of space. It's actually a CMS mini disk that the control program can read, and that's where all of your system configuration information is kept, your system configuration files, your logo files, the files containing the copies of the control program that you will IPL. You can have multiple copies of the control program in a file on the disk, on the PARM disk, and you just tell the loader program which one to load at IPL time, and we'll see an example of that a little later. So the PARM space contains your configuration files and your control program, the file containing your control program. DRCT, or direct space, is where we keep what we call the object directory. The user directory is kept in a basically in a file on a CMS disk, and when you run the DirectXA utility, it essentially compiles that file into a set of control structures that are written to the direct space on a CPU-owned volume. And when a system IPLs, that's where it goes to find information, the user directory information. So when you try to log on a user, create a virtual machine, that's where the system looks to see find the definitions for that virtual machine. I will use the term user and virtual machine. They're synonymously. So if I say user and I say virtual machine, I'm essentially talking about the same thing. I've been using them kind of interchangeably, so I don't want to get confused. Page space is for system paging. That's fairly obvious. You will page on your VM system. We like to say if you're not paging, you're not using your VM system, to its full capacity. So you will have page space. Spool space allocations. That's where we keep spool files, system dump files, and a special type of file called system data files. Things like name save systems and discontinuous save segments are system data files that are controlled by the control program, but their contents is kept in space that's allocated as spool space on your CPU-owned volume. And T-disk is a temporary disk. It's may or may not want to have space so your virtual machines can define temporary disk space for them to use for the duration of a single logon session. Okay. Now, I mentioned we call this the CP-owned list because on the next chart, we have an example of some CP-owned statements in your configuration file. You see three CP-owned statements there and a fourth slot that's defined as reserved. So you have this set of statements in your configuration file. You can have up to 255 slots with CP-owned volumes defined. The slot number is very important. Any volumes that have spool space allocated on them, once you assign them to a slot, you never want to change that slot number. So if you want to clean up your CP-owned list and, reshuffle your volumes, you never want to change the slot number designation for a volume that has spool space on it. If you do so, you will lose that data when the next time you IPL your system. Reserve slots are very important. Reserve slots give you the ability to dynamically add volumes to your CP-owned list while your system is up and running. If you have reserve slots defined and your system is running, you will be able to determine that you need to add some paging space or some spooling space, or you didn't initially allocate any space for temporary disk, but now you've decided you want to add some of that. You can while the system is up and running, you can add a volume to your CP-owned list for any kind of CP-owned space. And as soon as you add it to the system, you define it in a slot, the system will recognize that and start using the space on that volume. So it's very handy. Any slots that – anywhere there are gaps in your CPU-owned slot designations, the slot numbers within those gaps will be defined as reserve space. So One trick we like to say is you, no matter how many volumes you have, always make your last CPO statement say slot 255 reserved, and everything from the last volume in defined to 255 will be space that you can add volumes dynamically to your system. You define the space, use the CPFMTXA utility, which runs ICKDSF, and that will format the volumes for the control program and then allocate the types of space you want to use on each volume. When you install VM, you get a set of volumes, initial set of volumes, with all the types of space defined. But to do anything useful on your system, you will have to add some capacity, especially for page and spool. Once your system is up and running, you can issue the query CPOwn command, and that will show you a list of the volumes that are defined in those CPOwn statements in your configuration file. You see the example on the bottom of this chart. It basically repeats back what's defined in those CPOwn statements along with the real device number for each volume. If you want to see how much space you've used on any of these volumes, you issue the query alloc command. There are several variations of that that give you various looks at the data. You can look at all the CPOwn space. You can look at just the paging space, just the spooling space, or anything else out there with the query alloc command. Okay, memory. The control program manages real memory among all the virtual machines that are trying to get work done and have access to that real memory. I'm on chart number 12 now. Typically, in a production type system, you will have virtual machines active on your system that have more memory defined as their virtual memory than the total virtual memory of all those virtual machines will typically be more than the amount of real physical memory defined to your system. So the control program manages that memory among the virtual machines. When one is ready to run and do some work and make sure there's enough space and real memory for it, and by doing that, there's a set of algorithms that are used to define which other virtual machine pages it can move out of real memory or central memory and to make room for the current workload. And then, of course, we'll bring that virtual machine's pages back into memory when that virtual machine is ready to run and do some work. So all of virtual machine memory is pageable. We call it the man paging. We only move things out of memory if we need the space for something else. If there's nothing clamoring for the space, we won't just page out virtual machine's pages because maybe that virtual machine hasn't been active for a while. One of the keys on this chart, though, is expanded storage. If you come from a ZOS background, you know ZOS no longer uses expanded storage. For ZVM, you certainly do want to configure expanded storage on your system. The reason being, we page blocks of memory to expanded storage first before they get moved out to paging disk. It's a lot faster and more efficient to move pages from real memory to expanded storage than it is to do the I/O to disk. So we'll go to expanded storage first, and then when that's full or there's some algorithms, eventually some of the pages in expanded storage, if they haven't been referenced in a while, they'll be moved out. They'll be moved out to disk and then brought in from disk when they're needed. So you definitely want to configure some expanded storage for your ZVM system for performance reasons. Chart 13, CP spooling. The original, spooling, it does. It simulates unit record devices. So every virtual machine has a virtual printer, virtual punch, and virtual reader defined in its directory entry by default, and, of course, a virtual console. You can read files. We still use, even though we don't have real card readers or real card punches, maybe a few system real printers, but not so many of those anymore. But the spool system is used to send files exchange files among virtual machines. A lot of applications still use the spool files. A lot of your directory manager, your ESMs, they use the spool to send data between virtual machines, among their service virtual machines. So the spool is still used, even though we don't usually have the real devices that are associated with these virtual devices. It's still used heavily for system-related functions. So you have your virtual reader, which used to read cards, but you send a file to a user, it goes into that user's virtual reader, and they can receive that file and save it on disk or look at the contents of it. When you send the file, it gets written to a virtual punch or printer and then directed to wherever you specify to send it, maybe another virtual machine's virtual reader. So spool files are used for transferring information. You can use it to send data to real devices, to real printers, things like that. You can print a file. Virtual consoles are actually written to the virtual printer of that virtual machine, and then they can be saved, and that's good diagnostic information. I mentioned that earlier. Console output from each virtual machine is written to the virtual printer, so the spool is used for that. Dumps, if you take a dump of a virtual machine or the system, a system dump, that's done through the virtual printer as well. Not so much anymore, but years ago, email, the CP spool was used, it was heavily used for email within a VM system for office type applications. So what does the spool look like? Well, if you've been on a VM system, you issue a query reader, you'll see something on chart 14 now. You'll see something like what's at the top of that chart, and that just gives you what we call the descriptor information for the file. So that's kept in memory. The system keeps track. Each virtual machine has its own queue of files, and you can look at that list of files in memory. That part of the descriptor information, not what you see in the query, but part of what's kept with that information is the location on disk of where all of the data for each file is kept. So all of the contents of every spool file is kept on disk in those CP-owned volumes in the space you allocate for spool. So the descriptor contains a pointer to that, the contents of the descriptor for each file contains a pointer to the contents containing the data for each of those files. I mentioned system data files. These are kept in the spool as well on chart 15 now. So these are kept in the spool, but they're a special type of file mainly used by the control program for system-related functions. The type of these files you'll see most often now are NSS files for name-safe systems, and DCSS files for discontinuous save segment. The namesave segment, you can have a single copy, a named copy of an operating system. CMS is an example of one of those. And each virtual machine can IPL that. What happens is when you IPL an operating system in a virtual machine off by disk address, a copy of that operating system is moved into that virtual machine storage, and that virtual machine has its own copy of the system, but it's taking up space in that virtual machine's memory. This provides a way to have a name where there's a single copy of that system in memory, and each virtual machine that wants to use that system points to that single copy. So you're sharing multiple virtual machines are reading the same copy of and running the same copy of the operating system instead of each of them having its own copy. DCSSs are similar, except they usually have program code or most of the time that's a way to share data among guest operating systems. So there's a single copy of data that perhaps multiple guest systems want to have access to and read and update at the same time. So they'll all be pointing to that single copy instead of having their own copy of that data. The other types of system data files, NLS files for message repositories, for translated into various languages. Image library, if you have real system attached printers, There'll be an image library. There'll be an image file for each type of printer you have, and that contains the things like the character sets and the control things, FCBs, things like that for each type of printer. UCR is the old way to customize privilege classes for a given set of users and or commands. There's easier ways to do that now. I just put that on the list, so in case you see a UCR file, that's what it's for. You're not likely to see that very often anymore. TRF files or system trace files, these are a little different in that each user has its own queue of system trace files or TRF files. The other types of system data files, there's a single set of files on the system. Each user or each virtual machine could have a queue of system trace files. This is trace data that's generated by that virtual machine, created by the TR source commands and saved by the TR save command. Sometimes if you're having a problem, we'll send you something called the TR source file, which will keep track of, check certain things at certain points in the operating system as the system is running and collect data. And then we'll collect that data. We'll have you collect that data and send it in to help help diagnose a problem. So that's what that's used for. Okay, this is a good time to take a break and see if there's any questions.
All right, and ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question at this time, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone at this time. And again, we'll just pause for a moment to allow everyone a chance to signal. Mr. Franciscovich, it appears there are no questions at this time.
Okay, so we'll continue then. Let's move to chart 17, titled What You Need to IPLCP. On this chart, we see a high-level picture of the IPL volume that's created when you install ZVM. What's on that volume is the loader program called SAPL for Standalone Program Loader. That's the first thing that will be on that volume. So when you install VM, we set this all up for you. You can go out and change any of this you'd like. And we have the PARM disk. The PARM disk is installed as mains CF1 mini disk at a virtual address CF1. And remember I mentioned earlier the PARM disk contains the CP module, the copy of the control program, or you might have multiple copies that you'll want to IPL, the configuration files for your system, and logo files. It can have other things on it too, but that's primarily what's on that PARM disk. When you first install ZVM, you'll have three PARM disks that are identical, and they will be mains CF1, CF2, and CF3 mini disks. They'll all be identical, but as you start doing updates they're used for service and updating and testing, and then when you're ready to put a new configuration or a new copy of the control program into production, you move it back up to the CF, usually to the CF1 disk. So we set that up for you at install time. You can customize that, but we have procedures that's how we intend for those disks to be used. When you IPL ZVM, well, first we create the loader program. The loader program has a set of default IPL attributes so the default name of your system configuration file, the copy of the name of the file containing the control program that you want to IPL, and some various other attributes. So we set up a set of attributes. You can run SAL IPL to customize that set of default attributes if you'd like, or you never have to change them. But there's a utility called SAL IPL that lets you do that. When you IPL the control program, the loader program, it's loaded into memory. It locates the copy of the file containing the copy of the control program that you've told it you want to IPL, loads that copy of the control program into memory, and then transfers control, and the control program starts executing. The control program then goes to the PARM disk and locates the system configuration file that you've specified you want it to use, and processes the reads the statements in that configuration file and configures the system accordingly. It goes through all of its initialization, and the system comes up and is ready for you to start logging on virtual machines and doing some work. Again, we set it all up with defaults. You can change the defaults if you'd like. You never have to touch this until you do maintenance, apply service. You never have to touch these disks if that's your preference. I mentioned saving information, restoring information, saving information so we can restore it during IPL. Whenever you shut down the system, or if the system should take a restart, abend and restart itself, it saves all the environment information about what was going on in the system. So anything like accounting records that are in memory on the system but haven't been retrieved yet, status of the devices, spool files, system data files, all that information is saved whenever the system shuts itself down. And then when it restarts, all of that data will be restored. If you do an abend restart, that it will do a warm start, so it will store everything that was there when the system shut itself down or abended. When you do a regular IPL, you can specify, you'll be prompted, the operator will be prompted for what type of start you want to do. The one used most often is a warm start. A warm start says, put everything back the way it was. Bring back all the data, the state of the devices, put everything back to the way it was when I shut down. Now, most of the time, especially in a production environment, you'll do a warm start. A forced start, in case there was some kind of failure, the system didn't get to save its information, maybe there's a power failure or something, so the system didn't go through a shutdown, all that data didn't get saved. A forced start says, bring back, restore as much information as you can find. As much of the information as you can restore, I want to restore. Cold start says, throw everything away except those system data files. So all of the data that was saved will be ignored and not brought back to your system except for those system data files, those NSSs and DCSSs and other types of system data files. Those are the only things that will be restored to your system if you do a cold start IPL. If you do a clean start, that says start over, throw everything away. I don't care about anything that was there before. I'm starting from scratch. So we give you a lot of options. Again, the most typical is you're going to want all the data back that you had before you shut down, but there are other options, especially in a test environment, that you might want to use. So where is this information kept? There's two areas kept on a CPO-owned volume. Doesn't have to be the IPL volume. That's where we save it initially. But any volume, CPO-owned volume in perm space, you can set up a checkpoint area and a warm start area. So, again, a CPO-owned volume, and you define the location of these areas on a statement in your configuration file or system configuration file, called the system residence statement. So the example on chart 19 shows the system residence statement for the, we're talking about the checkpoint area right now. So we specify the volume ID, which at install is put on the res volume, that 540 or 610 res volume. Starts at cylinder 21, and the maximum amount of space you can reserve for checkpoint and warm start is 9 cylinders each. So we're saying I want my checkpoint area to be 9 cylinders starting on cylinder 21. And this is where data like the accounting records, the unit record devices, status, log messages, things like that are saved. They're all saved in the checkpoint area at shutdown time. We go to chart 20. The warm start area is where all of the information about the spool files on your system, spool files and system data files on your system, is saved. The warm start area is a little different than the checkpoint area in that all that's saved in the checkpoint area, basically the raw data is saved in that space. The warm start area just contains pointers to the location on those CPO and volumes, disk volumes, that contains the contents of each spool file and each system data file. So we'll go out to the volume, find the contents of each file, bring it into memory, and rebuild all those queues we talked about with each user's list of files. Another difference with the warm start area is it's maintained as the system is running. So it's maintained dynamically. As any file is created or deleted from your system, the warm start area is updated with the information for that file. The checkpoint area is only updated at shutdown time. So if something happens that you restart your system without doing a shutdown, that might be a case where you'll do a forced start, and there will be no data in the checkpoint area, but the data in the warm start area will be able to, that information will be restored to your system. Okay, let's move to chart 22 and talk about defining virtual machines. Virtual machines, I mentioned the user directory. Each virtual machine must be defined in the directory. When you log on a user, you're creating a virtual machine identified by that user ID. So the system will go in the directory. It will get what we call the static configuration for the virtual machine, the initial configuration for the virtual machine, that virtual machine's directory entry, and it will create a virtual environment that to that the whatever is running in that virtual machine looks like a real system environment. Okay, so your virtual processors, CPUs, you can define multiple virtual CPUs. The architecture mode of those CPUs, in the directory on chart 22, on the left there, we see we're defining two virtual CPUs in ESA architecture. User ID for this virtual machine is U1. It's logon password, the amount of virtual storage, the initial amount of virtual storage, and the maximum amount of virtual storage that can be defined for that virtual machine is all on that user statement. And that last G is the privilege class for that virtual machine. We'll talk about that in a little bit. You can specify a command in the directory entry for a virtual machine, and this command will be executed once the virtual machine is logged on and the environment is created, but before any operating system is IPL'd into that virtual machine. So if you want to attach a device to that virtual machine before the guest system gets IPL'd and starts executing, you can do that by putting a command right into the directory entry for that virtual machine on the command statement that you see there. The next several statements define the virtual devices, the virtual console, and virtual unit record devices that we talked about. The MDisk statements define what we call mini disk. A mini disk is a slight section on a real disk volume that is owned by this virtual machine, as defined on the MDisk statement. We specify it by the vol ID of the volume, how many cylinders, where it starts, and the read-write mode for that disk for this virtual machine. So this virtual machine, U1, that we're creating here, has two mini disks that it owns at virtual address 191 and 193. And to this virtual machine, those 9 and 17-cylinder mini disks look like full disk volumes, okay? And then there are two link statements, and that allows this virtual machine, that gives this virtual machine access to a mini disk that's owned by another virtual machine, in this case, Mainz. So this virtual machine is going to link to Mainz 190 and 19 Easy Disk, which typically contain your CMS operating system. And you'll notice up above, we actually IPL 190. Once we IPL what's on that 190 disk, once we have the link to it. So it's created. We create the virtual machine based on what's in the directory, define virtual processors, virtual devices, virtual memory, and again, the aggregate of the total virtual definitions for memory devices can be more than the available real resources. The aggregate of all the virtual machines running will typically be greater than the available real resources you have on your system, and the control program manages all that among the virtual machines. Chart 23, this is a simple flow. The key thing here is you can only have one instance of a virtual machine or of a user ID logged on to a single instance of VM at any given point in time. So when you try to log on a user, either with a logon command or an xautolog command from another virtual machine, the first thing, every virtual machine, in order to be logged on, must be defined in the user directory. If it's not in the directory, you can't log them on. If he's already logged on, we'll check. You can have a virtual machine that's logged on but not connected to any actual live session. And if he's disconnected and you're trying to log him on interactively, we'll connect that virtual machine to the current session. There's also a log on here command that you can issue. Instead of just log on, you say log on here, and that will move an active session from wherever it's active to the current session that you're trying to log on. So you can move an active user to another session, but there's only one copy of that virtual machine logged on at any given point in time. Okay, virtual machine connectivity. Chart 25. There's a function in the control program called IUCV, or Inter-User Communication Vehicle. This allows virtual machines to communicate through memory with other virtual machines, allows data to be passed through memory instead of over a connecting device like a channel-to-channel device, allows applications to exchange data, applications running on different virtual machines or an application to send data back and forth to other virtual machines. You can also define virtual connectors, or virtual channel-to-channel adapters, and virtual network interface cards. And you can send real data across those virtual connectors, as we'll see in a minute. So you can have virtual networking with these virtual connectors, send real data between virtual machines or to a network without any real physical connections. So IUCV, communications between an application and either other virtual machines, or there's a set of services provided by the control program that you can write an application that connects to a service through IUCV to interact with data provided by the control program. You can have transparent communication with ISFC. You can have a collection of VM systems in what we call an ISFC collection, or in a collection using ISFC, and they communicate and share resources, and once it's set up and active, it's transparent to the virtual machines where the resources they're accessing actually are resident. So that's very powerful. I'll picture that in a minute. And it also, these virtual connectors allow point-to-point networking between Linux and TCP/IP running on ZVM, on your ZVM system. Chart 27 is a picture of a VM collection using ISFC. If you're going to be doing VM for a while and are interested in things that are coming in the future, ISFC is something that will be good to get familiar with. You define a collection of ZVM systems, and they use ISFC to connect, and they can share resources. In the picture on this chart, we have a user on system VM1 trying to access a shared file system directory on system VM4, and because this whole picture is a collection of VM systems, it's transparent to the user that where he's really getting his data is from another VM instance in the collection. The way these connections are set up, if a connection is broken, any one of the connections is broken, if there is another way, another path to the system containing where the resource is resident, the ISFC will know about that and will find the path and will send the data over the alternate path. So as long as there's a there's a connected path between each image. Those images will still be able to exchange data even if one of the paths is severed for some reason. Chart 28 shows a guest LAN, a virtual network. This is the power of virtual networking. This is a guest LAN. We use virtual channel-to-channel connectors, virtual network interface cards to connect Linux guests and ZOS guests running on the same system through a guest LAN. So there's no physical connection, no physical network devices. The network is all defined within the VM, the ZVM system, and they communicate as though they're on a real LAN, send data across, and then there's a single real connection through VM TCP/IP to your external network. Chart 29 shows a virtual switch. This is used more commonly now than the guest LANs. So this allows you to create a ZVM virtual switch, again, with your virtual machines running guest operating systems. They have to use the virtual network interface cards, connectors, to a switch. The switch is connected to a single real OSA adapter, and that's your only physical connection to the outside network. But within your VM system, the switch controls communication from each virtual machine and the guests running in those virtual machines to the network. On the bottom left, you see a vSwitch controller. That's a controller virtual machine. Usually it's your TCP/IP virtual machine. So very powerful to have this virtual networking capability with the guest LANs and the virtual switch with no real physical connections within the guest systems themselves, within the guest virtual machines, and single connections to your physical connections to the network, to your external network. Okay, so how do we talk to CP? Chart 31. The most obvious way is by commands. There are a lot of CP commands used for various purposes. There are operator functions, get the status of various aspects of the system, to determine the settings of various characteristics of your system. You can do queries. You can change characteristics of the systems with the define commands or set commands, assigning and releasing resources, sending data between virtual machines, communication between virtual machines, messaging, things like that. A lot of commands. The type of commands each virtual machine can issue is determined by its privilege classes, which we'll talk about shortly. Chart 32, I talked about the command directory statement, where you can issue CP commands right from a directory entry or a virtual machine. Another thing that was added in one of the recent releases of ZVM, I think it was 5.4, is a for command. That allows a user to issue commands on behalf of another user. Again, you have to either be defined as a secondary user or have privilege class C, be a privilege class C user to use this for command, but can issue a command on behalf of another virtual machine. The command is actually executed on that virtual machine, but that virtual machine does not see, he'll see the effects of the command, but he does not see the command being issued, nor any of the responses or messages that are returned from that command. So the example here, we want to see how much virtual storage or virtual memory user U1 is using. So we issue a for U1. The command is query virtual storage. And on the operator, we get the response back, both from the query command that we issued and the final response that says the for command finished, that's the end of the output, and everything worked. User U1 will never on its console will never visibly notice that that command was issued. Right? Now, if you said for user 1 log off, of course, user 1 would notice that because he'd be logged off, but we wouldn't be doing that. Okay. Chart 33 is where has a diagram for privileged classes. I mentioned each virtual machine can have one or more privileged classes. Most virtual machines are going to be class G or general users. That says those virtual machines can only access and update their own data and can only do things within the scope of, affect things within the scope of their virtual machine. The privileged classes define essentially the power of the commands you have, the influence they can have, how broad the scope of the commands as far as virtual machines and the data they can alter. Okay, so most virtual machines can only affect their own data and do things to themselves. But you'll have things like your operator who can shut down the system. That would be a Class A virtual machine. Things like that. Shut down the system, force other users off the system. And we see the list of privileged classes. Resources, a Class B operator, somebody who can attach devices to another virtual machine, and so on. So the scope, each command scope of there are some commands, depending on the privilege class of the user, will have a different impact, will affect different users, different amounts of data. You see Class A through G here. When we ship ZVM, we use class A through G. Those are known as the IBM-defined privilege classes. The rest of the alphabet is yours to keep. You can modify privilege classes for users. As they're logged on, you can change your privilege classes if you have the right privilege class to do so. You can also modify the privilege classes of various commands. So if you want more users to have access to certain commands, you can modify the privilege class and give those users those privilege classes. Maybe you don't want your operator to be able to shut your system down. You want the system programmer to decide when to shut the system down. So you might define another privilege class and change the privilege class of the shutdown command from class A to, say, class Z, and make sure your operators don't have that privilege class. And only the people that you want to make those decisions have that privilege class to issue those commands. So we give you a lot of flexibility with the privilege classes to customize. There are also programming interfaces. I mentioned with IUCV, there's a set of system services. You can issue diagnose codes to the control program to get information from the control program. So we have commands. We have programming interfaces on chart 34. CP services give you access to data, give you access to data areas, control blocks, that are being used by CP. Chart 35, customizing CP. There's a function called that we call CP exit support. There are points in the control program where we have exit points where you can call customize, that you can create customized code. And by activating these various exit points, have your code run instead of the code that we supply, the base ZVM code. So this allows, if you want to modify how a command works or put a different message out, you can also write your own commands. You can write your own messages, things like that. So it gives you a lot of, if you're new to VM, you probably won't use this, but it gives you a lot of customizing capability. There's a book that talks specifically about this. It's the CP Customization Manual, if you're interested in finding out more about this. And you can activate your modifications dynamically while your system is running. You don't have to shut the system down to have your modifications become active or deactivate them as well. Okay, the last section is about diagnostic data. Several types of data. There's data that's collected by the control program as it's running, but there is data that you can collect that will help if we run into a situation, or say one of your guest systems you left it running when you went home tonight, and you come in tomorrow morning, and it's logged off the system. Well, what happened? So things like console logs can help you determine what happened when nobody was watching. So console messages can help. Of course, there are dumps. You can take it. You can dump a virtual machine's memory. The control program will dump if it takes an abend. Will create a dump that hopefully we can go back and see why the abend happened. You can also by command take a dump that's the equivalent of a CP abend dump while the system is running. Lots of ways you can trace, or we can trace for you, and lots of performance data. There are performance tools that you can use. PerfKit is the one that we supply with ZVM. Indicate commands, monitor data that's generated as the system is running. That all can be used to not only to help with performance, but can determine what events happened on the system that maybe led to some situation we might be in. The control program also creates a trace table that keeps a log of what's going on in the system and the flow through the code as the system is running. There are a lot of commands we can use. There's query commands, there's locate commands, display commands to collect additional data. So that's all out there for you. If you have a problem, you can call the support center, and we'll tell you what commands to use or what data you need to look at or what data to collect to send to us to try to figure out what's going on. Console messages, console logs. Chart 38 has the commands you would use to start saving the console into a spool file so we can look at it. So your operator console is always spooled, is always running unless you turn it off. But some of your key virtual machines, you want to have the console started so the data is being collected so you can look back through it. So spool console starts collecting the data into a file. When you want to stop, you should spool console stop, closes the file. You can stop and then restart and collect the data in the same file. Close closes each file so that you can actually go and look through it. You direct it to a virtual reader, and you can either peek it in the reader or receive it onto disk so you can look at the console file and see what was going on in that virtual machine. Chart 39 talks about CP dumps. They're written either into the spool or tape. A hard abend dump, that's when the control program restarts itself. It will take a dump. All the CP-owned memory that's active at that time will be included in the hard abend dump. A soft abend doesn't cause a system termination. It's basically within a virtual machine, so it's a smaller dump. A lot of times you won't be able to tell from a soft abend dump really what the problem was, but it also does not cause your system to restart. It just causes an interruption within a virtual machine usually. And a snap dump is a command that you can issue. It's the equivalent of a hard abend dump, but it doesn't cause your system to abend. So if something's going on in your system, you don't want it to abend, you would take a snap dump. It does quiesce all activity on the system for the duration of the time it takes to create the dump, so you will see some disruption to what's going on. It will definitely slow things down. But when the dump is done, your system will resume running as it was. You can take a dump of a virtual machine on chart 40, a single virtual machine. It's basically an unformatted dump of the memory in that virtual machine. And if you can't get your system up and running, there's a utility. You can take a standalone dump, and we can figure out why your system won't complete IPL. To process dumps, chart 41, there's most of the time they're directed by default to the reader, the virtual reader of user operatins. And then you use the VM dump tool that's supplied with ZVM to read the dumps. You issue VM dump tool, and it will bring up the dump and start formatting. What you see on chart 41 is the initial response when you issue VM dump tool from the dump. It tells you what kind of abend, what version of the system you are running, when it was IPL, things like that. At the bottom, it shows you what the admin was, and SVC2 means I issued a system restart command, basically to create this dump. But we'll show you the admin and give you a description, and then you can start issuing more commands to look at more of the data on the system. Another example is chart 42, is the trace table I mentioned generated by CP. This is a small subset of what would be in a trace table. It shows the flow through the code, things like that. A lot of other commands you can issue. It's very helpful in diagnosing problems. Most of the time, you'll just send the dump to us, and we'll run the dump tool and try to figure out what caused your problem so we can get it fixed. Chart 43, there's a trace command that you can do all kinds of tracing, various, you can trace by instruction, by memory alteration, things like that. Again, these are things you may need to use to diagnose, or we can guide you through if you need. And I mentioned the TR source and TR save commands earlier, and there's an example there on chart 43 of how you would issue that to look at a specific location in the code and look at various data to see hopefully what's going on to find the problem. Okay, chart 45, just to summarize, I did run a few minutes over. The control program manages the environment it runs in, whether it be an LPAR or a virtual machine, manages all the resources, the real resources available to it, among the virtual machines that are active and trying to do its work, preserves and restores data across IPLs. You have the virtual networking that you can use to create networks among your guest systems, and records diagnostic information so when there is a problem, we can figure out what's going on. Chart 46 just has a copy, has some web references, the VM library. You can look up the commands, the commands in the CP command reference, the CP planning and administration guide, has the configuration information, things like that. Another helpful resource is the IBM VM list server. It's a user run by our user community. A lot of questions out there, questions and answers, and discussion about things. We here in VM development monitor that, answer it when appropriate. Well, you know, if there's a question out there, we can answer. We'll answer it. So it's very powerful, very helpful, a lot of good questions, and a very helpful community. If you ask a question, you'll get several different answers to your question, but from everybody who's run into the same situation and had the same question at some point. So very friendly and very helpful. So I suggest going out there and looking at that list. That's all I have. So at this point, if there are any more questions, I'm finished with my presentation. So, final chance to ask questions. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to John.
And thank you, sir. Before we get to your questions, we'd like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer this question. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. And the question is, please rate the overall effectiveness and value of the call. If it was very good, please press star 1. If it was good, press star 2. If it was fair, press star 3. And if it was poor, press star 4. And we'll pause for just a brief moment. All right, and that does conclude our survey, and thank you all for your participation. Now let's move to your questions. Once again, to ask your questions, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. Once again, that is star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone. And once again, we'll pause for just a brief moment to allow everyone a chance to signal. And Mr. Ed, I do apologize. It looks like we do have a question from Edie Alves.
Yes. I'd like to know if it is possible to create an NSS to Linux in order to we can IPL Linux using that instead of using disk. Is that possible?
I am aware, not in NSS, but of Linux being used in DCSS file. So multiple virtual machines can share a copy of Linux. We can find out more and get more details about that if need be. I have never done it myself, but I know it has been done. If you send me an email, I can try to get more information and get back to you with more of the details about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, it's star one if you'd like to signal for questions. And again, we'll pause for just a brief moment. And Ms. Christina, your line is open if you'd like to ask a question.
Hi, it's Pam. I just wanted to mention that there is a technical paper about sharing and maintaining Linux under ZVM using DCSSs and an NSS, and it's on the ZVM website in the Linux section. I thought that just might be helpful to the last question, the person who asked the last question. That's it.
And at this time, with no further questions, I'd like to turn the call back over to our speakers.
Hey, John, thank you very much for finishing up the day for us. And just as a reminder, our three topics tomorrow will be Introduction to Linux on System Z, the value of open source and Linux on the mainframe, and ZVM order, install, and service overview. So hope you can join us. And John, we'll close out the call.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for attending.